In 1970, a 28-year-old recent law school graduate became the most wanted woman in America.
Angela Davis was replaced on the FBI's 10 most wanted list this afternoon by Bernadine Ray Dorn, described as an underground leader of the Weathermen.
They said she was an enemy of the state.
Within the next 14 days, we will attack a symbol or institution of American injustice.
A homegrown terrorist.
A bomb exploded early this morning in the Pentagon.
J. Edgar Hoover called her the most dangerous woman in America.
I'm going to read a declaration of a state of war.
This is Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7. Well, that report, the contents of it, nothing gets me more exorcised, I don't think, than remembering the communist movement and patterns of two particular people, Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn, because I'm from Chicago. I was there, intersected a lot of what they're talking about in that opening clip. And we're going to be talking about the broader topic today of communism. We're going to be talking about it with two experts. This is our second part, by the way. The first part was with Mike Gonzalez, who is an expert on communism with the Heritage Foundation. And today we're going to actually have more of Katie Gorka. Catherine Cornell Gorka is the wife of Sebastian Gorka, but Sebastian is well matched because Katie is an intellectual powerhouse in her own right, and she knows so much about communism, so you won't want to miss this. You know, you're listening to Sandy Rios 24/7, and I want to remind you that you can call us anytime at 662-821-2040. That's 662-821-2040. You can listen to the podcast on any podcast platform, but of course, AFR.net is our home base. You could also go to sandyrios.com and listen pretty easily. And you can write me at sandy@afr.net. By the way, last year, Preborn's network of clinics saved over 58,000 babies because of you. 58,000 babies because you were moved and decided you wanted to help save babies' lives. You made this possible, and I want to celebrate that with you. I want to tell you that there's a young couple named Matt and Ariel, and they found themselves in an unplanned pregnancy. They were scared, and they weren't sure what to do. I don't know anything else about their circumstances. But let me just say that by God's divine providence, they found their way to a Preborn partner clinic. And once they were there, the staff comforted them and introduced them to their baby by ultrasound, thanks to you. And in Ariel's own words, she said it was awesome. It was just awesome to see our daughter being formed inside me. So Matt and Ariel made their decision, and they decided to keep the baby. And they look forward to a lifetime of celebrating their baby girl. Well, thank you for making that possible. And if you haven't donated yet, would you consider doing that? $28 is for one ultrasound. You can go to preborn.com/Sandy, preborn.com/Sandy. And, of course, any gift beyond that just provides more ultrasounds and saves more babies. So whatever you can afford and generously give, go to preborn.com/Sandy. All right, well, stay tuned, because this is an important discussion. This is part two of our discussion on next-gen Marxism, what it is, and how to combat it on Sandy Rios 24/7.
From American Family Radio, Sandy Rios.
We are not called to be nice. We are often called to be confrontational.
And here with me in D.C. is Fox News contributor Sandy Rios.
I think the most important thing we need to demonstrate to our children is genuineness. That we actually believe what we say we believe.
A longtime Fox News contributor, Sandy Rios, thanks very much for being with us.
Seek justice. Not social justice, but God's justice. What's right and what's wrong.
Sandy Rios is with the American Family Association.
A pro-life radio talk show host.
We've got to say this is the line. Life is sacred.
Director of Governmental Affairs for the American Family Association.
Step up. Speak up. Say something. Do something. In part one of Next Gen Marxism, what it is and how to combat it, we spoke with both Catherine Cornell Gorka and Mike Gonzalez. Mike is one of my favorites. He's an expert on communism, and from experience, he's from Cuba, and also by his scholarship. He's just amazing. So that's in part one as we discuss that. Now, today, we continue that discussion, but today we're speaking primarily to Katie Gorka, Catherine Cornell Gorka, She formerly served as director for civil society of the Heritage Foundation, and prior to that, she worked as a presidential appointee in the Office of Policy at the Department of Homeland Security. And there she focused on strategies for prevention of terrorism and targeted violence. She was president of Threat Knowledge Group from 2014 to 2017, providing expertise and training on irregular warfare and terrorism to the FBI. U.S. Army Special Forces, Marine Corps, and law enforcement were also briefed by Katie. From 2009 to 2014, she was the executive director of the Westminster Institute, which she conducted research and education on threats posed by extremist ideologies. Some of you might remember on the morning show, I interviewed a Syrian nun who, at the time we were living in D.C., and I had a spiral staircase in the living room, very narrow, very small, very steep. And she was in her 60s at the time, which sounded oh so old, maybe 70s. And I wondered how she would climb those stairs. I hadn't met her yet. Well, she was from the mountains of Syria, and she mounted those that spiral staircase like she was climbing up the mountain. It was amazing. And we had an incredible interview. And that came to me through my friend Katie Gorka when she was with Westminster Institute. She has co-edited the volume Fighting the Ideological War, Winning Strategies for Communism to Islamism. She's a great scholar. And so we're going to continue today with part two, again, of our discussion of her book with Mike Gonzalez called Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. Catherine, help us to understand, we've said it, we've touched on it, but can you, in a word, tell us what the morphing has been? Prior to their era, American universities were some of the top in the world. Britain might have been ahead of them, but only Britain, as far as I can remember. We had the best school system in the world. What happened? How did communism seep in, and how did it change what was happening in curriculum?
Well, so there were, for as long as socialism has existed as an idea, it has enticed some people, right? Because they don't study history, or they don't know what it's going to lead to. And so, you had various organizations over time trying to introduce socialist ideas on campuses. I mean, that really started as early as the turn of the century, 1900. But there was something special that really happened in the 1950s. And so I would say it was a couple things. I think one is you had major American writers.
I'll leave you in extremely capable hands with the greatest author ever, Catherine Cornell Gorka, Katie Gorka, to me and you. So I'm going to go now.
That's high praise from you, because you're a marvelous author yourself, Mike, and great intellect. And I so appreciate you joining us and giving us your time. So go give it to them there, wherever you're speaking. The book is called Next Gen Marxism, What It Is and How to Combat It. Mike Gonzalez and Catherine Cornell Gorka, otherwise known to me as Katie, are the authors of that book. And it's available right now on Amazon and other places where books are sold. Okay, Katie, continue, please.
Yeah, so I would say a couple key things happened. You had major American authors who were seduced by the ideas of communism, and those ideas kind of came out in their books, and those books became, part of the mainstream. I mean, people like Jack London, Upton Sinclair, Arthur Miller. And so you had these ideas kind of seeping into the culture. But there was something very particular that happened in the late 1950s, which is the development of what was called the New Left. And so this was in the United States, and it happened elsewhere, France and Germany, but let's just focus on the United States, an all-out rejection of Soviet communism, right? This would have been right after the death of Stalin and Khrushchev came in. And, the Americans said, no, it's not Soviet communism we want. It's a different kind of communism. It's not the worker who's going to be the locus of revolution. It will be students and intellectuals. And you know what really blew my mind as we were doing our research was finding out that Harvard University actually invited Fidel Castro to come speak to students just months after he had carried out the revolution in Cuba. And you wonder why Harvard is where it is today. You know, it's crazy. But, you know, essentially what you had happen in the late 50s was a real shift away from, you know, actually an outright rejection of Soviet communism and a real shift to what was then called the New Left. And this was the belief that the revolution was not going to happen because of the worker, but it would be students now who brought about the revolution. And you know, you had things like the birth of Students for a Democratic Society, right? The radical students who then went into American cities to foment revolution there. And that was really, I would say, the birth of, you know, today's radicalism. You know, that's it really did originate with the radical students of the 60s. And we are seeing their legacy today because the bottom line is, you know, as we've discussed with Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers, another one is Eric Mann. These people are all still alive. They are shaping the culture still.
There's no question about that. And I want us to at least touch on, I want to bring it up to more current before we run out of time here. In 2023, you guys write in your introductions, Americans were again shocked to see students rally on campuses across the country, but especially on the supposedly elite ones in defense of Hamas killing spree in Israel. What has happened to America? Were the George Floyd protests and riots simply a spontaneous response to the unjust death of one man, or was something more at work? All right, so I think the George Floyd protests, most people who are paying attention, like my listeners, would know that that was kind of well, I should ask you, Katie, how did that sort of foment the Black Lives Matter and get that whole thing kicked off?
Yeah, so this is, I think one of the most insightful things in our book, and I really have to credit Mike with doing the groundwork on this one. You know, he discovered this whole sort of back history of European and Latin American Marxists who started to get together, you know, back, I think, around 2007, trying to figure out how do you bring about revolution in different countries. And then eventually, so they were gathering more in Latin American countries, and then they started, and Americans actually started going to those meetings, but then eventually they said, you guys need to do your own thing up in the United States. Why don't you start organizing? And you know, some of the co-founders of Black Lives Matter were very much a part of that early movement. So that stuff was happening early on. And what they were able to do was they were basically ready when you had an incident such as the George Floyd murder, killing, they had the possibility to then use that to kind of set off riots around the country. They were organized. They had a whole network. You know, as they themselves claim, they have stated openly, they sent out hundreds of millions of texts mobilizing people. So those were not spontaneous protests. Right? Those were engineered and organized. And that's another thing that I think people have to realize. I think a lot of well-meaning people got sucked into that. The women in the suburbs who put the Black Lives Matter sign in their yard, I don't think that they are evil. I think that they're ignorant. I don't think they understand fully what it is they say they're supporting. And I think if they understood it, they'd take that sign out of their yard.
Yes, I agree with you. And, of course, that wasn't the only manifestation. We had Antifa, which, can you just say a word about that, Katie? Our FBI director tells us it's not an organized group, and so we can't know much about it. We know they wear black. Actually, I'm going to stop just a second and play a short clip to give people a reminder of who they are and what they've done. This would be clip 8.
Bad, really bad.
In the past year, it seems like Antifa has been everywhere. Building burned down in Minnesota? Antifa. Looting in Soho? Probably Antifa. Capitol violently overrun by people wearing MAGA hats? definitely Antifa in disguise. And while we've been told that Antifa is a well-organized, well-funded network of violent extremists, historian Mark Bray says that's not it at all.
It's a radical left politics of opposition to the far right that doesn't rely on the police or the courts or the state to stop the fascist threat.
When black lives are under attack,
what do we do?
Stand up, fight back!
Sometimes I compare it to feminism, right? There are feminist groups, but feminism itself is not a group. There are Antifa groups, but Antifa itself is not a group. Anti-fascism, broadly speaking, goes back as far as fascism. Groups like the Arditi del Popolo, which oppose Mussolini's fascists, to groups like Anti-Fascist Action, which fought Hitler's Nazis in Germany, and many other anti-fascist forces in Europe and around the world.
Throughout World War II, fascists were pretty easy to spot. That became a little harder once they'd stopped wearing their brown shirts.
All
right, I'm going to interject. That's an production by Vice News, and of course they're maintaining that Antifa is anti-fascist. That means they would be against Hitler and his troops, and they would be against Mussolini and his troops. And of course the inference is that Antifa is simply, you know, fighting the fascism of, I think, Donald Trump is who they're inferring there. But Katie, are they Marxist or not? Do we know?
I think that's a good question. They are absolutely out for destruction, and I completely disagree that they're not organized. I mean, I was there as well on Inauguration Day. We saw the destruction by the people wearing black. And then I encountered them also very directly after that one particular Republican convention. I was at the White House. We were coming out of the White House gates, and basically the whole area was surrounded by Antifa, who was, you know, people who were provoking police, provoking us. Some of the people did research on who they were. And these are the same people popping up at all different events. They had hotel rooms in expensive hotels. These were not just down and out people like spontaneously rising up against the right. No, this was organized. They are organized. And, you know, one of the problems, and I can say this because I worked there, one of the problems is the Department of Homeland Security. So you've got a really big problem where the people who are supposed to be keeping an eye on domestic extremists like Antifa themselves, the quote experts themselves, have a hard left orientation. They don't even pay attention to these groups. All they do is pay attention to what they call the far right extremists. This is a very serious problem that we have.
No question about that. And so I think they're infecting our children because they believe in destroying the family, sexual anarchy. They are destroying our economy because they want to destroy this country. They are destroying all the structures. And yet you guys, in your book, Next Gen Marxism, What Is It and How to Combat It, bring some optimism. I think people don't really understand that, Katie. And so why is it that you're so positive about this, about the outcome, potential outcome?
Yeah. I have to be optimistic given who I'm married to. No, I mean, look, I'm a fighter. My husband has made me a fighter, truly. You know, he has shown me that nothing the other side does to us can hurt us. And so we have to fight. And so, I'll tell you, when I left Heritage 2 years ago, summer 2022, I left for two reasons. One was I said, I need to get away so I can write this book with Mike. But the other was I said, I'm going to get more involved in my community because I don't believe Washington can fix this. Or in any event, Washington can't fix it by itself, right? This is in our communities. We have to fix this in our communities. And I said, I'm going to get more involved in Fairfax County and do whatever I can to help fix this. And I will just tell you, on Saturday, I was just elected head of the Fairfax GOP.
Oh, my gosh.
That's what makes me up. Yeah. So that's part of what keeps me optimistic. You know, in the course of that race, I talked to probably hundreds of people. And I'm telling you, there is such a hunger and such a maybe I won't say optimism, but I will say enthusiasm. People want to fight. They are fed up with what they're seeing. They're fed up with the failed policies of the left. they want to fight back. I think they just don't always know how to fight back. And that's, you know, that's part of what we outline in the book, is we put tools in people's hands and try to encourage them to go out and take this fight to the left. Come on, our country is worth fighting for.
Yeah, absolutely. Amen and amen. And I would say it's been my experience through the years of, you know, fighting this eternal battle, because it is kind of eternal. It's just a dark forces that we cannot see. Is that when I get busy, when I get involved, when I do something, I am more encouraged instead of sitting there being the victim. So I think that you're right about that, Catherine. One more practical question before I let you go, because I didn't ask you this, and I want to because it's in the headlines. How is Marxism connected in any way to the pro-Palestine, pro-Hamas hordes we see in our streets? They are, I'm guessing, mostly Islamists or people who are a Muslim. So what is the connection? And how are they connected?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, oh, yes, absolutely. And again, we document this in the book. So it's very interesting because some of the pro-Palestinian activists were very much a part of those early organizing events, you know, both in Latin America and here. They've been a part of this from the beginning. And, you know, I don't know if you saw it, but there was a fascinating clip. I think Elon Musk posted it. I know Mike reposted it from a couple weeks ago, where there was a pro-Palestinian demonstrator who was caught on tape saying, explaining to somebody, you know, this isn't really about Palestine. This is about taking down America. So they are, you know, these are, you know, kind of all different pieces of the same movement to destroy America and to destroy what we have here.
Okay, Katie, this is just a treasure trove of information. You and Mike have done a great job, and both our view are great writers, great thinkers. It's called Next Gen Marxism. What is it and how to combat it? And I highly recommend it. It's available anywhere where books are sold. Catherine Cornell Gorka, wife of Sebastian, who is a champion on her own, and then is more of a champion beside him. That's what makes them such a great team. Katie, I appreciate your time so much, and God bless each of you and your family, and keep you strong and safe, because you've done so much to push back on this for the whole country. So thank you for that. And so thank you. And this is Sandy Rios on Sandy Rios 24/7.
This is Sandy Rios 24/7 on American Family Radio.
As you're listening to this podcast, and again, that's Sandy Rios, and I want to thank you so much for listening. If you have the means, I wonder if you would consider a leadership gift to saving babies with preborn in a bigger way. It's a tax-deductible donation, and one of $5,000, for instance, would sponsor Preborn's entire network for 24 hours. And that usually saves the average of 200 babies. I mean, that's amazing, isn't it, when you think about how that money would be spent. And they do have an incredible track record of saving babies. To donate, all you have to do is go to preborn.com/Sandy. And, of course, if that's too much money for you, $28 provides one ultrasound. So whatever you can afford, go to preborn.com/Sandy. Hi, this is Sandy Rios, and I miss you in the mornings. But now I'm hosting a podcast, Sandy Rios 24/7, which is available at AFR.net and SandyRios.com. Well, I finally finished that book. God's Velvet Hammer chronicles God's call in my life, from a small town girl to Berlin, Germany, Radio Moscow to North Korea to Washington, D.C. I talk about Sasha Girl. It was my disabled daughter. I talk about I've Got the Music in Me. That's a chapter on my music life. Lost in India and Other Adventures is hilarious. You won't want to miss it. I talk about my sweetheart, The Blessing of Bruce. And then a mysterious chapter called My Green Face and the End of It All. Oh, I think you'll enjoy it. Like the Apostle Paul, these are my shipwrecks and my adventures, all for Christ and His kingdom. God's Velvet Hammer is available wherever books are sold. And remember, Sandy Rios 24/7 is available at AFR.net and SandyRios.com.
Today, we spend the hour with an activist who replaced Angela Davis on the FBI's 10 most wanted list, Bernadine Dorn, leader of the radical 60s and 70s organization called the Weather Underground. It was 50 years ago this year that they bombed the Pentagon to protest the Vietnam War. They also battled with police during days of rage on the streets of Chicago and partnered with black liberation groups to rob banks. When Bernadine Dorn and her fellow Weather Underground activist husband Bill Ayers literally went underground to avoid arrest, they then raised a family as they continued to fight for revolution.
That's really odd. This is Sandy Rios back with you. That's from Mother Country Radical. And you would think, by the way she's talking, that this is going to be an expose on these criminals, as it should be, and we're sort of exposing them. But no. If you listen to Mother Country Radical, they're celebrating Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers, noted communists that we've discussed with Katie and Michael, and you've heard what I've had to say about it, at least in part. I have to say, what years ago, when I was in Chicago the second time around, that was after my stint at CWA. This is probably 2005, I'm guessing, something like that, 2006. I was watching television one night and happened upon a PBS documentary that was all about the Weather Underground, and I was just fascinated. It was definitely not Mother Country Radical. It was like the correct perspective. These guys were criminals who wanted to violently overthrow the United States of America. And so we did a long expose of that on my radio show, and I actually asked Bill Ayers to come in and talk to us, and that never quite happened, but we worked on it. So this is this particular area of communism is very interesting to me. But I noticed on that opening that we played of the show today, of this part two, by the way, I've asked Bruce to join me. Hi, sweetheart.
Hello.
A former FBI agent, retired, and also former prosecutor in Cook County. This is all Chicago, at least the Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers part of it. But I noticed in that first clip, Bruce, of Mother Country Radical, the FBI, Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn were on the FBI's 10 most wanted list. And J. Edgar Hoover himself called Bernadine Dorn the most wanted woman in America. I think that's pretty amazing. And that reminds me, you know, like about just going back in time, give us some history about the FBI and communism.
Well, you know, when J. Edgar Hoover called Bernadine Dorn the most dangerous woman in America, you have to understand the background of J. Edgar Hoover and communism. His ties and his experience with communism goes all the way back to 1919. I don't think a lot of people understand what's happened in America in 100 years with communism. I mean, this goes all the way back to the turn of the 20th century. There were bombings in New York City, a series of them. J. Edgar Hoover was a young man. He was working for an attorney general named Palmer, and the communists tried to blow up Mr. Palmer's house in Washington, D.C. They set off a bomb in front of his house. The bomber, unfortunately for him, activated the bomb too soon and blew himself up, but it damaged the front of Palmer's house. And in fact, when this happened, FDR and his wife were living directly across the street. Of course, he wasn't the president at that time, but he was the Secretary of the Navy.
Bruce, I know you're mid-sentence, but I just want to put this in time. This is
1919.
Okay, so just to put this in perspective internationally, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia took place in 1917. And, of course, they were spreading communism into Germany, which got Hitler furious when he came to power. He hated the communists, but they were evangelistic. They wanted to take over the whole world. So that 1919 puts that in perspective. 1917, the Bolshevik Revolution in Russia.
Yeah, so you can see it was coming here to America. And, in fact, 1920, there was a bombing on Wall Street. I mean, can you imagine? Right at noon on Wall Street on a work day, a bomb was set off by communists as a protest against capitalism. So J. Edgar Hoover, that's his experience beginning with communism. And, you know, we we tend to, in fact, if you remember during the debates when Barack Obama was debating and Mitt Romney brought up Russia, Obama mocked him and said, oh, you know, go back to the 1960s. And you have to remember, communism has been pursuing our country for over 100 years. Back in 1945, when the Manhattan Project was in Los Alamos, New Mexico, and the United States was trying to develop an atomic bomb, there were communist spies within the scientists, a person by the name of Klaus Fuchs, who was a British scientist working on the atom bomb project. He leaked to the Russians many of the secrets of the atomic bomb. We were way ahead of the Russians in technology. They wouldn't have had the bomb for years. But within 2 or 3 years after we developed the atomic bomb, the Russians had one. And there was a project called the Venona Project. And this was a secret U.S. project. And they were reading, they were able to decrypt the cables that were going back and forth between Moscow and Russian agents here in the United States. And they were aware that there was a series of spies in the United States that were what were basically KGB agents. And in fact, in 1945, a woman by the name of Elizabeth Bentley came to the FBI, and she told them, I have been serving as a courier for a ring of Russian spies that are gathering American secrets. But she, unfortunately, she did not have any paperwork or any hard evidence, and so the FBI was never able to corroborate what she said. But I will say this, shortly after knowledge of her coming forward got out, the Russians removed many of their KGB people from the United States. And later, when the Soviet Union fell, there were documents unearthed that proved that, in fact, what Elizabeth Bentley had told the FBI was true.
But I know you're going to get to this. I think you will. But, you know, there were two people executed in 1953 in this country. It was Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Yes. And they were convicted of passing secret information about the atomic bomb to the Soviets in 1945.
Yes. And, you know, a lot of people try to act like that was being driven by the FBI for publicity. But the evidence against the Rosenbergs really was very strong. And later again, when Soviet Russia fell, there was paperwork that showed the Rosenbergs were in fact committing espionage, and as just a side fact, J. Edgar Hoover actually wrote a letter to the judge in the Rosenberg trial that he thought Mrs. Rosenberg should not receive the death penalty because they had two small children.
How interesting!
And the judge did not care. The judge was convinced that they had done this, and both Julius and his wife were executed.
We also know the Soviets, the communists, had infiltrated into the highest levels of government, into the Roosevelt administration. That came later. There was one of his chief advisors was, we know now, part of the Communist Party. And so then people will know at least something about this. Ronald Reagan was a famous actor in Hollywood during parts of this, and he became the president of the Screen Actors Guild from 1947 to 1952, which is also during this era. And he then, that's when he used to do, well, at least in part, I believe this is when it started, his radio talks on communism. He mm-hmm. educated the country on communism and went after them in Hollywood.
And, you know, a lot of people will tell you that Joseph McCarthy, a senator from Wisconsin who led these hearings to root out communists, they will really bad talk him. But I'll tell you what, a lot of what he came up with ended up being true, and there were a lot of communists within the United States government that needed rooting out, and unfortunately his efforts got sidetracked by other issues. But this, as we say again, has been a problem for over 100 years, communism trying to take down capitalism.
Yes, and in regard to Hollywood, people that are still skeptical on, you know, the witch hunt, I forget what they call it. They have a name for it. And they say it with disdain. But remember that the communists are experts at propaganda. I've said, I believe at this mic, and it's actually, I know, in my book, people say, it is in my book, God's Velvet Hammer, about how good they were at propaganda. That was their only Hitler, I guess, rivaled them in propaganda. That was the way communist socialists controlled people, was to spread lies in a very creative way. And Hitler was one of the first to use it through movie production. And so the Nazis, you know, went into Hollywood. They saw the power of that. Hollywood tried to emulate it. And when the Nazis fell and the communists became the power, why would it surprise anyone that they would descend on Hollywood and try to make movies to persuade the American people that communism was not so bad? That's the goal, after all, and to destroy the country. So,
And what a more effective way to change people's opinions than the mass, especially at that time when there was no television, the mass appeal of movies and the vast audience that would reach. But, and I think at that time we were, probably still are, but we were very naive and thought everyone in Hollywood was on our side and was a good
American. Because so many of them were. You know, they joined the Air Force. You had Ronald Reagan. You had patriots. But we don't see that now, and there's a reason. Remember, part of the goal of communism is to break down the family, too, the moral values in the family. It's anarchism among the sexual mores to break down any establishment of things like religion or the notion of God. So they worked hand in hand. And then when I was growing up, and I'm a little older than you are, but we had bomb shelters. People were building bomb shelters because Khrushchev was in power in the early 60s, and I remember as a girl watching him take off his shoe and bang it on the podium at the United Nations, saying to us, the United States, we will bury you. So somehow we moved from that, where we were very cognizant. We grew up knowing all about this. We knew what they taught. We knew they wanted to destroy us. We lived through the Cuban Missile Crisis, where for, 10 days, 2 weeks, we hardly breathed because they were in Cuba with missiles, trying to build those to point at us. And then somehow we moved to this place where to say anything was a product of communism or that there were communists to this, you were the object of derision if you dared to say something like that. And they did that very well. Or they erased it as a common notion or understanding among the American people. They did it through schools, they did it through media, and as you just said, a great example was Barack Obama mocking Mitt Romney for mentioning that Russia was an issue and communism was an issue. So here we are, and we didn't even talk about Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers. But I would just say again, in this part two, if I didn't say it in part two, Bill Ayers grew up to be a man who wrote and created education textbooks for universities, and his stuff has been used all over the country. In fact, I took on Wheaton College many years ago because they were using stuff written by Bill Ayers in their education department. And Bill Ayers, you know, you could say, well, that was so long ago. He's probably different now. Oh, no. On 9/11, the day that we were attacked by the Islamists, Bill Ayers is in a full-page color magazine cover. I believe it was Newsweek or Time. And he is standing on the American flag in a suit, standing proudly. And he says, it's basically guilty as sin, free as a bird. Or guilty as H-E-L-L. I actually think that's what it said. Free as a bird. That's the unrepentant Bill Ayers, who went on to work for the University of Illinois. Circle Campus, I think it was.
You know, we watched it right in front of our own eyes. I remember the Democratic Convention back in the 60s in Chicago when the Weather Underground, the SDS, the communists were there trying to disrupt the convention. And those people were, well, let's say they were treated less than nicely by the Chicago police, and a lot of them went underground literally because they were afraid. But what they did was they cut their hair, they got educated, and they picked institutions to go into, many of them going into the university system, where they could have a huge impact on young minds, which are always very malleable. And you get a guy who is a good presenter and talks a smooth game like Bill Ayers, and you can convince a lot of people about a lot of silly things.
Well, and Bernadine Dorn goes to Northwestern, the most, dangerous woman in the United States. So declared the first FBI director, J. Edgar Hoover. Northwestern, one of the most powerful universities, notable academic excellence in the country. So they succeeded, except I would say, I believe that Chicago 68 convention was a stake in the heart of the communist movement, of the revolution, which Bernadine and Bill so badly wanted then. You know, they actually are on tape. Now you can't find that documentary I mentioned. You can't find it. But I remember her on tape saying that they wanted a violent overthrow of the United States of America.
Yeah, they were not kidding. This was not a bunch of young people just showing out, trying to have a good time and, you know, talk some smack. This was an actual plan, and there were steps taken. You heard them. Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers were involved in a bomb set off in the Pentagon. Now, if you can't, you know, if that isn't proof for you that these people were serious, I don't know what you need.
One more thing. I mentioned that this in the part one, but I want to mention it again. A friend of mine, while I was prepping for these shows, sent me a photo that she had taken of Bernadine Dorn and Bill Ayers and a few of their buddies on the streets of Washington the day of President Trump's inauguration, when all of the ladies with the pink hats and all the violence started, the resistance, shall we say, the resist movement, smiling broadly. They're still in the middle of it. And by the way, we can't leave today without saying that they were the chief advisors of Barack Obama and Michelle. Very close friends, neighbors, I don't care what they say, this is what happened. And that was their influence and their buddies in Chicago and in even now, probably, very close. So
it was amazing, the connection between Obama and Bill Ayers, and I believe Bill Ayers hosted Obama in Ayers' home when he was running for president.
That was his first campaign event, was in their home.
And now you cannot find any evidence of that.
Oh, and Bill Ayers actually ghost wrote Obama's Dreams from My Father. So there's just, we could go on and on. We could go on and on, but you get the point. If you want an academic treatment of this, which is very readable, and good stuff. It's Next Gen Marxism, what it is and how to combat it. Katie makes the point, and I will repeat, that communism has never worked. Never. Anywhere it's ever been tried, it has never worked. It has its poisonous day. It causes the death of millions of people everywhere it goes. But it never succeeds, because when people wake up and see how dreadful the policies are and where they are actually being led, they rebel. And so that's our hope. That's our hope. And of course, it's anti-God, and our biggest hope is in the power of God to combat it through us. So there you go. This is part two of Next Gen Marxism, what it is and how to combat it, on this edition of Sandy Rios 24/7.